Hello, listeners. Jordan here. I just want to let you know that you can listen to Nighttime early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Include it with Prime.
You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Hello, listeners. In tonight's episode, I'm going to be discussing one of the darkest and one of the most unusual crime sprees to ever have occurred in my city, Halifax, Nova Scotia. For a period of weeks in May of 2007, it appeared a serial killer may have been targeting our city's gay community. But in the end, it turned out to be something altogether different. To put it bluntly, the killer thought he was destroying vampires. So yeah, this story is as unusual as it is tragic. To help me talk through the story and to join me in the discussion that surrounds the many elements to this case, I've invited a good friend and fellow podcaster, Christy Lee from Canadian True Crime, to join me. So let's get to it. Tonight, in this episode of Nighttime, we're going to be discussing the story of Glenn Race. Christy, I'm absolutely delighted to have you on the show again. You're like a returning guest. You've been on a few times at this point, I think.
I have. And it's great to be asked to come on Nighttime. Like, it's my favorite show, and you are the best of the podcast hosts. So I feel like I am talking to a celebrity every time I come on the show. It's an honor, a privilege. Yeah.
Talking to a celebrity. You've just complained to a celebrity for the last 30 minutes before we hit record, but
I told you not to tell anyone about that.
Well, sorry, your dirty secret's out there. You're not as sweet as you try to play it out on your show. Why don't you, for people who are listening to us now that don't know you or your show, why don't you tell us about Canadian True Crime?
Yeah, so Canadian True Crime is a podcast that I started in my closet 3.5 years ago. And basically, I just wanted to tell stories of Canadian crimes. And in case you haven't noticed, I do have an Australian accent. Sorry, you know that, but your listeners don't, may not. I have an Australian accent. I'm originally from Australia, but I've been here in Canada for 11 years. And so for all intents and purposes, I consider myself a full Canadian. And I've really gotten into Canadian crimes, and I like to tell the stories in a kind of immersive single narrator format with background music. And it's kind of a case by case situation, similar to you, but it's generally just me narrating as opposed to your episodes, which are more conversational. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And you covered a lot. Like, a lot of my listeners, I think, know my show for covering stories from the East Coast of Canada, which you've covered a lot of. You did the, it's Harshbarger, murder from Newfoundland last month.
Yeah, the Mark Harshbarger case. I've done the Jane Hirschman, Billy Stafford case. And of course, we did the Loretta Saunders episode.
We did that together. That was about a year ago. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I forgot about that, because I've had that episode that you did for that case on my feed. So I think listeners will maybe haven't checked out your show, will at least have heard your Australian accent and been like, that doesn't sound like Jordan. And I love that your introduction always includes like an explanation as to why you have an accent. One of my favorite things about your show is reading people's like comments or reviews or whatever, where they're questioning, how dare you have an accent?
Well, actually, I only changed my intro a couple of episodes ago. Before, I just used to say, this is Christy and you're listening to Canadian True Crime. And I think any newbies that found the podcast were like, what the hell? And demanding that whoever puts out the podcast needs to get a new host, because this Australian is just not cutting it. So I guess I kind of edited my introduction to say, I'm Christy, an Australian living in Canada. And this is my independent podcast type thing. And hopefully through doing that and being proactive with my communication, I can manage the expectations of any newbies coming in that think it's the official true crime podcast of Canada or something.
You're so mature. That's such a mature way to handle it. Well, let's get into the case we have here.
Yes.
I've invited you to talk about a case from my hometown of Halifax that I don't believe you've heard of this case before I wrote to you. You've never heard of Glenn Race or the series of crimes that he was charged with?
And no.
Some were he was convicted of, but this all went down in May of 2007. So I'll tell you a bit about how I experienced this at the time, because this happened in my city of Halifax. In fact, he lived very near me when this went down, although I didn't know that until years later. But in May of 2007 in Halifax, there was two men went missing in a very short amount of time. They were like a week apart or 2 weeks apart. And very quickly, the local police put out a statement warning gay men to be careful. And there was suspicion that somebody, you know, maybe not a serial killer, was targeting gay men. And the reason for that is the first two victims of this crime were both gay men who were last seen in areas that I don't even know what you would call it, but it's like not like swinging, but like men would go for consensual connections with other men. Do you know what I'm trying to say? I don't know the polite way to say
that. I don't even know what I'm thinking of. Michael, what's his face? Let's go outside. What's his name? That British guy.
George Michael.
Yeah, George Michael.
Yeah, exactly that sort of thing. One of them is happened near Citadel Hill. Citadel Hill, for someone who isn't from Halifax, it's a, like kind of a military base built into a hill in the center of our downtown. The military base isn't active anymore. Once upon a time, it like watched the harbor and had cannons and all this stuff. But what's there now is this long winding road that goes around the hill and leads to where tourists can go see the military base during the day. But anyway, at night, people will drive up there and like go cruising, and you can kind of you may pull over your car and maybe wait to meet up with someone else to, you know, have sexual interaction with. In fact, one of my first times after moving to Halifax, I was walking home from a bar with a few friends, and we decided to stop and take a break to have a cigarette. And not being from Halifax or really knowing, we decided to take that break on the side of the Citadel Hill next to a tree. So it's like 3 a.m. or something, and we're just sitting next to this tree, like talking and having a cigarette. And then I heard kind of like a rustle behind me. And when we looked, we realized that we decided to sit down right next to two people who were probably wanted a bit of privacy. But anyway, I don't shame anyone for getting enjoyment out of their life in any way that they decide to, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else.
But absolutely.
But in this case, the police put out a warning saying, you know, the two people are missing, both have connections with the gay community in terms of like visiting these kind of, I don't know even what you would call it, like cruising spots or something like that. So the word around Halifax was that there's some serial killer targeting men. People were really freaked out, and slowly the bodies of the missing men were found murdered. It got even scarier and darker. Ultimately, a couple weeks later, an arrest was made at the Mexican border, is where the story's going to take us. And it was a young man from Halifax, a 26-year-old man named Glenn Race, was arrested at the Mexican border. And in his wake, there would be a whole series of crimes in the most bizarre story that would come out of it. It turned out, as you'll hear, he wasn't targeting gay men. He thought he was killing vampires and demons. And it gets really, really bizarre. But this story, it's fascinating because of just how bizarre it is, but the fact that this was able to happen and the legal fallout that will come from this story as well is could be its own episode of the show. So I think what we'll do tonight is we'll just talk through the timeline. I've had a chance to prep you a bit on Glenn Race's story and, you know, what he was accused and convicted of, but I figure we should just talk through it. How's that sound?
Perfect.
Through any of this, Christy, did you see pictures of Glenn Race? Did you get a look at what he looks like or anything like that?
Yeah, I did. And I watched an interview of his on YouTube when he's in prison. And he seems like he's got a lot of insight into what happened. I feel a little bit sorry for him.
Yeah, I absolutely do. I have an uncle who is mentally unwell. So when I hear a story like the one we're going to get into with Glenn Race, or the story I covered with your help before on Rohini Bissazar. I just, like, the mental illness is a really terrifying thing, and I don't believe the law is able to properly manage it, as we'll hear in this story. But
yeah.
Glenn Race, like, when you see him now, like in that video you're talking about, he's gained a bit of weight being in prison and being medicated and stuff. But
yeah.
at the time that this happened, he was a really like good looking guy. He looked kind of like Johnny Depp. Is kind of the look he had. I've always thought of him as like a Johnny Depp looking guy. But when you look at his life, it was completely normal. He was born in March of 81. So he's about the same age as I am. And from a similar family. He has a younger brother named Doug. He has his mother and his dad who it's just when you hear about them as a family, it's a very regular family. They lived outside of the city. They did a lot of camping, a lot of Glenn and his brother did a lot of like kind of athletic stuff. But it seems like a really normal upbringing for people who live in Nova Scotia on the outside of Halifax. And in fact, I know people who either went to school with Glenn or played on sports teams and stuff with him. And they describe him as just a regular, down-to-earth, normal guy. But for whatever reason, well, I think we'll probably hear the reason, but around the year 2000, things really started to change for him. And his parents had noticed, I guess you would say, a deterioration in his kind of his mental health, going from just the regular guy, slowly becoming more and more kind of offbeat and paranoid. And I think you watch that YouTube video that was filmed after he was in prison. He was very like kind of medicated, and it was kind of the vibe I got. Is that what you got from it?
Yes, he was very even. You know, there was no kind of up and down in his voice. He was just kind of flat.
Yeah. And I think that must be – I'm guessing it's the result of probably pretty heavy medication that he'll be getting in prison. But
yeah.
What's said to have happened is around 2000, he was at Dalhousie University, which is a major university in Halifax. And he dropped out of school during his second term and moved back in with his parents who lived outside of the city. But when he did, it wasn't like – I'm dropping out of school. I'm moving home. It's like he dropped out, moved into their basement with no – wouldn't have lights, wouldn't have telephones, TVs, and was like almost like starving himself and was obsessed with the idea of cleansing his body. Like so like eating really healthy or really mild like bread and water sort of thing, which is I can only imagine his parents were like, what the heck is going on? Like it must have been a startling change, which led to a series of visits with, you know, mental health hospitals and crisis centers. This seems like it's going to be one of those stories from the very beginning that is based on his parents struggling to figure out what's going on with him and getting him help. And I'm sure you've come across a lot of stories like that because it seems to be a common thing.
Absolutely, yeah. And the one that I covered, the Brentwood Five, Matthew DeGroot, who stabbed those five people in Calgary, it seems like his didn't take such a long period of time to come on. It was kind of a little bit sudden. Whereas Glenn here, it's getting worse over a period of time, and his parents are like aware every time and trying to get him help. And I really feel for them because it's clear like how desperate they were to get him help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was at this point, very quickly after the first few visits to the hospital or whatnot, he would be diagnosed as schizophrenic. And I think I'm not an expert on schizophrenia, but some people are okay with getting treatment and can live like a normal life and manage their illness. Some people take a different route. And Glenn is said to be one of the people that didn't actually believe he was sick, didn't want to take his medicine. And it almost led to this almost like combative relationship between Glenn, the healthcare providers, and his parents, I'm sure, who were just trying to get him help. So all the while he's not having his illness properly managed, he just gets worse and worse. And it's around this point that he begins to develop a belief in vampires, in demons. So it sounds weird, but he truly believed that there were vampires and demons on Earth. And he began to take on the role of like, I am like sent by God or commanded by God to stop these demons and identify these demons. I think the cleansing that he was going through came into that. But there was even like if you read articles about his story, you'll find 1,000 bizarre little experiences that his parents have shared with Glenn, like him during this period of time after the year 2000 when he dropped out of school. At one point, I think he went in his bedroom at his parents' house and he painted everything in the bedroom white, like his bed, his walls, his floor, himself, head to toe, covered in white. I think he came out of the room. I've heard a few different accounts of this, but I think he came out of the room carrying a Bible, also painted completely white. So it's wow. Like we're talking about someone who really went off the deep ends, for lack of a better way to say it.
Lost his grip on reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure it was scary for the people around him, but it was also dangerous for him. He set himself on fire at one point in his parents' backyard. I think this was in and around 2005 or 2006. He set himself on fire and was put into the hospital with serious injuries. But since he was in the hospital, he was given his medicine and was said to have improved. And this is what really kind of sets up the story that's going to play out here is through this hospital visit, being properly treated, routinely given the right medicine, a schizophrenic can control their illness, as Glenn did for a period of time leading up to 2006. He was managing his schizophrenia, and what he decided to do was he wanted to move out of his parents' house and live on his own, which, like, in reading this story, it seems like I don't know how that was a good idea for anyone, but I could see why his parents would want to support him if that's what he decided to do.
Yeah, it seems like really his parents were very, very supportive, and instead of telling him no all the time, they would just kind of go along with whatever his he was doing lately, you know?
Yeah, but at the same time, seeing your son very sick, your child very sick, that would be horrifying. But then seeing them getting better and getting medicine, like I could see how could kind of get swept up with like, all right, things are going to be okay. We're, you know, not to say it was like denial or something, but I could see this happening. But
totally.
Regardless, he in May of 2007, so about 6 or 7 years after he began to show symptoms of schizophrenia, he got his own apartment in the north end of Halifax. I actually lived like 3 blocks away from him at that time. And when this crime happened, I had no idea that that he lived that close to me. But what we'll get through in the next segment, we'll talk through Glenn's first apartment and how that positioned him to really go downhill. We're in May of 2007 now. Glenn gets his own apartment in the north end of Halifax. The first day that he's living there is the day that the first turn, which coincidentally turned out to be a gay man, goes missing. Court documents for that are associated with this case have a really clear timeline built up of what Glenn did all throughout this several week stint. So I'll kind of talk through some of what he did during his first day. So he moves into an apartment, the north end of Halifax. He does some very generic stuff, gets groceries, goes to the bank. He visits a library, and this may become important, but he takes out a couple books, one of which is a book about Mexico. And that's important because when we get further into this, Mexico ties into this case. From there, so he runs around his average day. As this is happening, there's a man named Paul Knott. He's a 44-year-old guy, retired. He was with his daughter shopping. I don't know where exactly they were shopping, but they were out on a daddy and daughter night, or afternoon shopping. As evening approaches, he drops her off at home, or at work, I believe, and goes on about his evening. Paul Knott, however, after dropping off his daughter, I don't believe he was ever seen again. We do know that Paul Knott and Glenn Race managed to cross paths not far from Glenn's apartment, which was on Citadel Hill, that area that I told you about.
Mm-hmm.
In the story of what plays out on Citadel Hill is pretty shocking. This comes from the court documents. There was like an agreed statement of facts that eventually came out where as much as possible that's known about this case is shared. So I won't get heavily into it, but what they believe happened is that Paul Knott was driving his car up to Citadel Hill, maybe cruising for other men. Somehow he met Glenn. Glenn got in his car with him. What is said to happen is Glenn ordered him to repent for his sins. Again, keep in mind that Glenn was obsessed with the idea of demons and vampires. Glenn is said to have ordered him to do that. Whether he did or didn't is probably irrelevant, but Glenn eventually very quickly slashed his throat, stabbed him several times, and that's how Paul Knott dies, is probably completely unexpecting anything like this to happen. He just met the worst possible person to run into, I think, is what happened.
That must have been a horrific, horrific death for him to have to suffer through.
Inside a car, too. It's just the idea, if you play that out in your head, which I don't recommend doing, it's just, it's very frightening. In Citadel Hill is a really dark place. It's not like there's streetlights up there, and it's not nice at all. What happens from there is Glenn Race takes his car, and what's important to follow in this is there's a question of whether Glenn Race was completely insane, not understanding what he was doing, or if he did understand and should suffer the severe consequences. What is interesting is he's very meticulous in covering his tracks, which is I don't know what that says about how sick he was at the time, but he was very clever in what he did. What Glenn did at this point is he took the car, drove about a half hour outside of the city, and dropped the body off in a wooded area, just in the middle of nowhere where no one would, very quickly find him. from there, he, after dropping off the body, he then drops off the car in a different area. And when he drops off the car, it's another remote road kind of out by the Halifax Airport, which is outside of the city. He carved into, I think it was in the hood of the car, he carved, "Waiting for my friend's tow truck. Thanks." He had his bike stashed in the trunk of Paul Knott's car. He took his bicycle out, drove to a gas station, and from there called his dad to pick him up. So again, it seems like when you hear this, it seems pretty planned and methodical, like to divert attention by putting in "I'm waiting for my friend's tow truck" and stuff. I don't know what an insane person would do, or someone who's, not criminally responsible for a major crime. I don't know what they would do, but that just seems really deliberate and thought out.
It does. It does. And I know the two cases that I've looked into, this Matthew DeGroot case and also Vincent Lee, those guys made no attempt to cover up what they had done. In fact, they seemed to believe that what they were doing at the time was the right thing. So it's really weird that this guy was hearing these voices and felt like he had to do something, but also felt like he had to cover it up. That seems a little different to me. And I'm not saying that it wasn't correct, that he was still having an episode, but yeah, it is a little different.
Yeah. So he's out in the middle of the night at a gas station near the airport outside of the city. He calls his dad, who lives probably about an hour and a half away from there, I would think, or maybe an hour away. So his dad comes and picks him up. I'm sure they had a strange talk about what was going on and why Glenn was out there and needed a ride home. But his dad, I'm thinking, based on this fact alone, I'm thinking his dad suspected something was wrong. Instead of driving Glenn back to his apartment in the north end of Halifax, he drove Glenn to his parents' house, which is in Windsor, a community outside of Halifax, and took him there for not just overnight. He brought Glenn back for, I think, a week or two. But from the very beginning, like the account Glenn's father shared of that car ride, He described Glenn getting in the back seat, and as his dad was looking in the rearview mirror at the back seat at his son, he could see Glenn would take a deep breath and hold his breath for really long periods of time, which is strange. But I think it's something that he was said to do often, is like hold his breath for really long periods of time. But I think even the next day, like I'm sure they would have known that his illness was coming back, because they also, I believe, the next day they saw him in the backyard arguing with someone that wasn't there. Like it was almost like he was having like a physical altercation and yelling with someone who there was no one there. They just saw him outside doing that. So I'm thinking they knew something was very wrong, but whatever it was, it must have passed, because it was actually a week later that they drove Glenn back to Halifax. So he ended up spending a week with them. During that week, all over the news would have been, there's a missing man in Halifax. I remember there being posters everywhere for Paul Knott. His name all over the news, his family members and daughter and people who knew him talking out like, my dad would never, run away like this. Something's going on. Aww. But yeah, it was really when you live in a city the size of Halifax, whenever there's a missing persons case that turns bad, it just really sticks with you. Because I can remember several times that you would see the posters up like, have you seen this person? And then you will see a news report of, either a body found, or in, say, like the case of Loretta Saunders, which we covered, a major news story of, a murder. And I can remember after Loretta was found dead and people were arrested and whatnot, I still remember not far from my house on a pole was like this old poster that people hung up when they were looking for her. And I remember seeing it one day and just seeing it, like realizing like how dark the whole situation was. But with Glenn Race, that's not the only time it would happen. Keep in mind, he was May 1st is when he killed Paul Knott, went to his parents' house for a week. May 7th, His dad dropped him back off at his apartment at in Halifax. That night, it's all going to happen again. This time, it's a 45-year-old man, another gay man named Trevor Brewster, who was a server at this restaurant that I go to often with my mom called Steak and Stein, which is like, let's say if you wanted to go to the Keg, but you only had like $8, you can go to Steak and Stein. And that's basically what it is. It's like decent steak for cheap, basically.
Great.
Yeah, it's a good place. If you ever come to Halifax, we'll
go. That'll be my treat.
Yeah. But Trevor Brewster was a longtime server at the Steak and Stein. When he was getting off his shift, he had plans to meet a friend later that evening, but he wouldn't show up. What eventually happened is his body was found under a dock on a near a lake. It's called Frenchman's Lake. It's in Dartmouth, which is the neighboring city to Halifax. His body was found not long after, kind of tucked under this wharf on the lake. This wharf also is an area used – or not the wharf, but this lake is also an area that people frequent for cruising, kind of like Citadel Hill. So
right.
when he went missing and they found his body in this area, it's the same kind of location as Citadel Hill in terms of its late night reputation. Mm-hmm. So obviously the police were putting out warnings and it was thought that – you know, it's somebody maybe targeting gay men. And when he was found, he was also, much like Paul Knott, he was without his car. Trevor Brewster's body was found. His car was missing. So I remember when this happened, photos of it. It was like, I think it was a white Honda Civic or a black Honda Civic. There was pictures everywhere. Like, if you see this car, call police. Here's the license plate. You know, it was one of those situations where an all points bulletin sort of thing in the press to keep a lookout for this specific car. But in a city the size of Halifax, two men go missing under these similar circumstances. It's totally reasonable to think someone was targeting, men with that kind of lifestyle.
100%. And I would like to know if that was his goal or if those were random locations. It's very strange.
The only thing I can think of is it would be vulnerable targets if people are meeting strangers like that and letting them in their cars and whatnot. But for Glenn, if Glenn, like, you wouldn't just happen upon these two places. And like, if you're just walking around, it's not like you're going to walk there and someone's going to be like, "Hey, you want to like come hang out?" you would need to, like,
there's a reason to go there.
Yeah, like maybe he went there knowing this would be a spot that he could be alone with someone. But I don't know if that question will ever get answered. And the story, to be honest, is already weird and dark, but it's just going to get completely wild because Glenn, after committing these two murders, he decides to flee Canada. Using initially Trevor Brewster's car. What Glenn eventually said, his explanation for why he fled Canada was an archangel, like a spiritual being, directed him to do this. So he was, in his mind, was on like a mission from God that had these far-reaching supernatural kind of messages within it. So I think if you believe in his defense that we'll eventually talk about, he thought he was on a mission from God to cleanse the earth of – I don't think it had anything to do with like homosexuality. I think it was a delusion of like vampires and demons and, you know, this kind of illogical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a few points where after the murder at the lake in Dartmouth, leaving with Brewster's car, there's a few points where he would make contact with police, mainly later that evening. After midnight, he squealed the tires of the car that he was driving. Police officers were behind him and saw it and took note of the license plate, but he drove off at such a speed that they decided not to pursue him. Like, I guess they'll make decisions about, you know, whether it's worth chasing someone or whatever, if, you know, they don't want to get people hurt. They eventually took down the license plate of the car he was driving. I believe they flashed their lights, but he sped off and they didn't pursue him. Glenn had also said that he saw that as a sign that some like all-powerful being up above was like going to protect him during his time fleeing the country, which, yeah, I just, in my mind, I try to think of what he must have been thinking. And if he's completely delusional, I then question how he was able to be so methodical about a lot of the things he was doing. Like he managed to pass through a toll station. There's a toll booth kind of at the border between Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. He not only went through the toll station and would have had to pay a toll, but he even asked for directions on how to get to the United States, which...
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know. It just... to do that, you just need to have kind of your feet on the ground, I think, without raising suspicion.
And even to drive a car when you're like in the middle of an episode, I mean... Yeah, it does seem like it has an element of planning and he had a plan, you know?
But at the same time, he could have thought that the police and the government were in on this kind of battle that he thought he was waging. So maybe a part of his delusion was he needed to plan and be prepared so he could get away with it. It doesn't seem like he's making it up as he goes. Why he planned it and, you know, what he was thinking is another question. But he managed to get across Canada. He got in Brewster's car. He got to, I think, to Quebec, and he ditched the car in a wooded area and crossed the U.S. border on foot. He walked, I think, from Quebec into New York on foot. And we're over the period of maybe 2 or 3 days it took him to get from Nova Scotia to rural New York. He ran into a couple people there. A few witnesses recalled seeing like a kind of an odd looking guy, you know, walking down like their country road where they didn't see people. I think a couple people had encountered him and asked like what he was doing or who he was and didn't really get straight answers. It was more so like, I'm out for a walk. He, I believe, had like maps and compasses and all this stuff with him. So he was probably a bit of a sight. But what he did find was the community's called Moores in New York. It's right on the Canadian border, Canadian-American border. But he managed to find an old... It was still in use. It was like a hunting cabin / cottage, something kind of in the middle there, like a really rough kind of cabin that he broke into. Again, at this point in New York, there's a lot of photos that go around of this cabin. When you watched the videos or read about this, did you see anything specific to this cabin?
No, I didn't.
It's just like if you picture if you went out to like cottage country outside of Ontario somewhere and just found like a little cabin boarded up that a family spent like a couple weeks in the summer or something, maybe surrounded by trees and maybe a dirt road. It was that sort of thing. He managed to break into it. I think there was an open window is how he got in there is what they said. But while he was in there, he found a gun, like a loaded rifle. Coincidentally, while he's in there, a 35-year-old man named Darcy Manor. He was a school bus driver, a father with two children. He was sent to the hunting cabin or the cottage or whatever you want to call it by the owner, asking to prepare it like for them to visit in the summer. Because again, this is happening at the beginning of May. So he was like hired to prep the place and get it ready for them for when they show up in the summer. He showed up at the property driving an F-250 truck, a 92 truck. So an older big truck. And he was outside fixing a water pump, having no idea that Glenn Race with a gun was hiding in the cabin, watching him through a window. it's likely that Darcy Manor didn't hear or see anything before Glenn shot him at very close range, shot out the window that went through his, hit him from behind, punctured his lung, and killed him within a very short amount of time. And I wonder if he even knew what had happened.
That's so, so sad.
In just completely senseless. Like, when you think of, like, to say it's senseless is such an understatement, but it's almost like getting hit by lightning. It's like you could, to walk into a situation like he did.
Yeah.
With this guy from another country hiding out in this cabin in the middle of nowhere, you would, and then the chance that there's a gun in there and the chance that you show up at the same time, like, it's a one in a billion chance that you walk into a situation like this.
Yeah, but wrong place, wrong time, wrong everything.
Yeah.
Poor guy.
And to the, like, 10th degree, like, I can't imagine the that kind of luck. But much like the prior cases, in Halifax, Glenn Race hid the body. He, I won't get into too much detail, but he dragged the body a good distance and hid it, and not in the truck, using an ATV that was out there. So there must've been some motorcycle kind of things. And oh much, God. Much how Glenn Race saw the police not stopping him in Halifax as a sign that someone was protecting him, he believed that Darcy Manor appearing at the cabin with a truck was like a prearranged thing from God. Like, he saw this as like a, almost like a gift to him. Like, you know, we're going to send someone there to bring you a truck. You're a demon slayer, is how he saw it. So now he's in the middle of nowhere, about 10 days from the first murder. He now has a close to 20 year old truck to continue on his journey. So he's in upstate New York, I think you would call it, like right on the Canadian-American border. He spends several days traveling close to 5,000 kilometers from New York, traveling towards the Mexican border, with little more than a backpack with some odds and ends in it, like maps and compasses, knives. He drives through, you know, if you think of the map, New York to Mexico, you're driving right through the United States. What eventually will happen is the truck gets a flat tire in Texas. So he abandons the truck. He has the wherewithal to get a bus a good amount of the way to the border. When the bus drops him off, he approaches a cab driver and asks for the cab driver to drop him off at the Mexican border. So we're now at the Mexican border with Glenn Race, you know, getting out of a cab, having just killed three people, disheveled, long, black, curly hair, a backpack, probably a pretty heavy tan, having been, you know, spent like a close to 2 weeks kind of out in the mid-May sun, which is enough to not yep. The kind of sun you'd want to drive through Texas in, I imagine.
No.
So in the next, we'll take a quick break. When we get back, we'll talk through what happens with Glenn Race at the border. Sorry to pull you away from the episode, but I want to take a moment to thank the subscribers of the Nighttime Premium feed, as it's their support that makes this show possible. If any of you listening enjoy Nighttime and aren't subscribed to the premium feed, let me take a quick moment and explain what you're missing. For about the price of a cup of coffee, you can subscribe to a different podcast feed in which the episodes are posted earlier than here in the free feed and are done without any advertising. But there's more benefits to the premium feed than simply better versions of the free content. The premium feed also includes post-show discussions and a variety of additional content that will take you even further into the rabbit holes. So if you got a couple dollars to pitch in towards the creation of Nighttime, the premium feed is for you. You can access the premium feed at patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. So with that said, again, a huge thanks to all subscribers to the premium feed, and a thank you to everyone else listening for considering it. Now, let's get back to the episode. So I can, from watching TV, I can picture the way it works at a border. It's not the kind of thing, especially at the American-Mexican border, it's not the kind of thing you can just walk across the way. I understand that in this particular spot that he arrived at, there was like a lake or a river that divides Canada or America from Mexico with like a bridge that you pass. So it's a very tightly controlled border. You need to get through this bridge. Glenn Race isn't about to walk across the bridge and check himself out or check himself through whatever that process would be. It looks like what he tries to do is sneak across, but he probably doesn't realize that this border is so intense that they have like motion tracking and all this stuff. So that's what eventually gets him. A border guard receives notice that there's motion at the border, and that guard goes over there in his vehicle to check it out. The border guard sees a disheveled guy, you know, the scruffy beard and long greasy hair and stuff, kind of like milling about at the border. The border guard approaches him and says, you know, what are you doing over here? Let me see your ID. What's said to happen is Glenn Race puts down his backpack and opens it up as if he's going to grab his ID or his passport or whatever. But the border guard notices the butt end of a rifle sticking out of the bag. Glenn probably didn't intend to let him see that. When he sees the gun right away, the border guard is, you know, like, put your hands up, get on the ground. Glenn Race does not at all comply. Glenn dives at him, trying to take the guard's gun. A shuffle ensues that results in Glenn getting beat up a bit, as you'll see in his arrest photos. His face is all busted up. But
I did see that.
Okay, you did or you didn't?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really freaky photo because Glenn's face, he has a few cuts, but his eyes are clenched really tight shut in the arrest photo. But Glenn manages to he bites the guy a few times. I think he bites his face and his hands a little bit before the officer or the guard or whatever the proper term is, gets the gun on Glenn and says, you know, like, I'm going to kill you if you don't comply. Glenn does. Backup arrives. He's taken into custody, but what they find in his bag is enough that they know there's problems. He has, for one, the gun that I mentioned, loaded. He has makeup that's made to like camouflage her face, like green and black, kind of like army makeup. He has Mexican money. He has the driver's license of Trevor Brewster, a credit card for Darcy Manor. So he has like all this stuff right away that's connecting him to these prior murders that, you know, they're looking for people for. And not only that, he completely shuts down when he's arrested. He won't open his eyes. He won't answer any of their questions. Apparently what he said was over and over again, he kept repeating the phrase walking in circles, whatever that means. He apparently, from the time they put him in the car to even after he was brought to wherever they would lock him up, a jail or whatnot, he was repeating that phrase over and over again with his eyes shut. When they brought him in his cell and they go back to check on him, much like we heard described in his parents' backyard after the first murder, he was alone in a prison cell in like a violent fight with somebody that wasn't there, like yelling, punching, throwing himself around. So I think right away, I'm sure they know, like, you know, something wild
right.
is happening. So knowing what you know about the story at this point, Christy, does this seem like if this was going to court, do you think NCR is going to be the defense, meaning not criminally responsible for people who don't know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It would be because, and they, it's so weird because they have evidence on both sides. You know, they have his parents and his medical records to talk about the lead up to the crimes that he committed. But then on the other side, there's all that planning. And yeah, you're right. The planning could have been part of the schizophrenic episode that he was in. But he certainly did seem to have a lot more wherewithal than other not criminally responsible offenders that I have heard about.
Yeah, me as well. Like when I did the story about Rohini Bissassar in Toronto who committed the stabbing, it was like her story, it's so absurd and bizarre what she did and how it all went down that the only explanation is she was like having a bizarre episode. In his case, it's almost like he's handling it like he's in the military or something. It's all like planned and deliberate and cautious. But the story. So, and then the other complicating factor in this is there's now two murders in Canada and one in the United States. Both countries have completely different ways of handling this. But he's in custody in the U.S. because that's where he's arrested. So before he'll ever face charges in Canada, a very bizarre trial happens in New York that could be its own episode of this podcast, because it starts off with them going for the defense, the American equivalent of NCR. But there was this really weird stuff that went on from the very beginning of the trial. There was new information was released by the prosecution, and that information was, as soon as the trial started, that information came out, and it was I think it was like 70 hours of phone calls between Glenn from prison and his parents, and the prosecution were making a case for he wasn't insane at the time, because these calls from his parents show that the things he said in it made it sound like he knew what he was doing and he was more in better mental shape than, you know, than what the defense was letting the court and believe. What eventually would happen, I won't, like, we'll spare all the back and forth, but eventually what would happen is Glenn Race's defense team would decide to change their strategy from him being not criminally responsible due to like a mental defect to he didn't do it. And they try to make a case for there's no evidence to convict him of Darcy Manor's murder. But he had the gun. He had connections to the vehicle. I think he had his credit card. He was found guilty of murder in the United States and given a life sentence.
A life without the possibility of parole sentence for Glenn Race, convicted of murdering a Moores, New York man, still facing charges for killing two men in Nova Scotia.
That's what we wanted. It's what he deserved. After sitting through the trial and listening to him, he is not remorseful. He doesn't care. It's just, it was what we, nothing we could have asked for anything better.
It was what I expected. This case certainly called out for a life without parole.
The district attorney says had it been allowed in New York, he would have sought the death penalty for the 26-year-old of Halifax. During a three-week trial in September, Race did not testify. And while questions were raised over his mental capacity, he had been diagnosed as schizophrenic in Canada, a not guilty by reason of mental defect defense wasn't used. At the sentencing, Glenn Race addressed the court, telling the judge and a crowd of about 70, "With understanding I'm an international and celestial citizen with human rights on earth transcended to the cosmic community, I can truly say without doubt I am innocent," after which a few people in the courtroom laughed.
He will remain incarcerated in New York State for the rest or remainder of his life.
Or in Canada, the DA says under a treaty, Race could petition to serve his time north of the border.
There's still a huge debate about whether or not he should get a retrial, and his family, Glenn Race's family, and some the lawyers that will eventually represent him in Canada, because there's going to be more trials coming up, they're still trying to argue that he wasn't given a fair shot at that trial in New York, that his lawyer erred in multiple ways. That lawyer has since, that represented Glenn in New York, has since left the profession and I think left on bad terms. I think there was another case that was botched that eventually led to him leaving. And I think he now runs like a golf course or something, to give you
Wow, that's quite a career pivot.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's real. I just can't imagine that happening, where a defense team changes their strategy all based on the fact that new evidence came, and that isn't enough to. I don't know. It just seemed, when you hear the story of, like, I read through the court documents related to that case in New York, and it's very complicated because there's a lot of, like, kind of the sidebar arguments about legal statutes and if this information should be allowed or not. But eventually what would happen is Glenn's lawyers wanted more time to review the phone calls and to get new professionals to review the phone calls and make a decision about whether or not he was sick at the time that he made the phone calls. But the judge didn't want to add any delays to the case and felt like Glenn's lawyer should have been able to get it done faster, rather than, I guess, figure it out as they went. They just changed their strategy to a strategy of, he's not guilty. He wasn't there and he didn't do it. And that didn't work. In Nova Scotia is when he's given life sentence in the U.S., but he is still has a trial in Nova Scotia for the two murders, which goes exactly how you would have expected, is they have psychologists take the stand. They have his medical records from, from 2000 and on, when he first became ill. When that's shown, both the defense and the prosecution agreed that his illness came into play. And I guess what I didn't realize is when this happens in like an NCR case like that, they still have a trial, but the trial more so isn't about like proving guilt or innocence or anything. It's more just doing the interviews and having people on the stand and putting all the facts there for the public record. And then the judge will make a decision on the facts that are presented. And the expectation is that the judge will rule that they were not criminally responsible. That's what happened in Glenn's case. He was found not criminally responsible in Canada for the two murders that he committed here. But almost as soon as that verdict was issued, he got on a plane or bus or whatever and was shipped back to the United States to serve the rest of his time at a prison there.
It's so weird. Was he sentenced in Canada?
No, because it's – well, with not criminally responsible, he would have been sentenced more so to psychiatric care and, that aspect of things. But they didn't have a chance to do any of that, because he would then need to go back to New York to serve his sentence in the U.S. And I believe there's been a lot of legal wrangling that's happened since then, trying to get him back to Canada, trying to get him a retrial in New York. But, these trials happened 10 years ago. And now what he's doing, you saw that YouTube video, he's just sitting in a prison in the U.S. And apparently what he does with his time is works on quote unquote inventions. Apparently he's invented, I don't know if he actually manufactured any of these, but apparently he's invented some kind of underwear that always stay dry. It is said that he still is resistant to believing that he's ill. And I've seen.
Really?
Yeah. And I've seen his brother quote it saying, people criticize Glenn for not showing remorse, but in Glenn's case, or in Glenn's situation, in a lot of ways, he still believes, what he set out to do was real. So it doesn't seem
weird.
He's better.
If he is truly in rehabilitation, then I'm sure he would have had some insight into what he had done That's really weird. There's so many anomalies with this case.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really bizarre and it's really sad. And like, I just think when someone has not all schizophrenics will take this route, of course. So I don't want to make it sound like someone gets schizophrenia and they're a danger. But when someone has a mental illness like schizophrenia, it seems like there's nothing you can do to help them or stop them until they do something like this that's horrible. And even then, they don't really get help, because if he's in general population in a prison, yeah, he may be mandated to take his medicine at a certain amount of time, but a lot of the programs and stuff in a prison that the public thinks people are forced to do, it's all voluntary. Like, you can go to prison and you can go through these courses of anger management and all this stuff, but it's all voluntary. The only reason a lot of people do it is because it looks good come parole time.
Parole, yep.
What you could do instead is you could just sit in your cell and think you're inventing things and watch TV for 25 years while you serve your sentence. Not to say that's what Glenn's doing, but his family has spoken publicly and made it sound like maybe he isn't getting, you know, the treatment he should be getting in an American prison. And that doesn't seem right.
No. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me, though. Like, American prisons aren't really set up for that type of thing. It's all about punishment and retribution and not so much rehabilitation, which is more what the Canadian system focuses on. And obviously there are issues with that system.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's said that it's easier for people to seek treatment after they've committed a crime than before, because it is hard to find a psychiatrist. I've heard that there is waiting periods in Canada of like months and months to find a psychiatrist. So if you've got a serious mental illness and you need to see a psychiatrist, and I don't mean a psychologist because those guys cannot prescribe medication, then you're waiting months and months and months. And in that time, you could commit a crime. And it's only after that that you'll receive the help that you need. Like, there's a mental health crisis. It's disappointing, you know?
It absolutely is. And then I also think about all the families involved. Like, for Glenn, it's like his life is gone. He's not, I wouldn't say he threw away his life, but his illness seemingly took his life away from him. Then you think of his family, who's a, you know, regular family. We were talking about our kids having eczema. This is, instead of, you know, we're probably feeling pretty fortunate now that our kids suffer from eczema, because it's like something like this could happen in the same way we talk about trying to find the right creams to prevent our kids' eczema. It's not that hard, because we'll go to the pharmacy and maybe see our doctor, try a few different things, it gets under control. But imagine if what you're trying to treat is your kid going in the bedroom and painting everything white, or sleeping with a knife and, you know, enchanting weird things and arguing with invisible people in the backyard. And, you know, you finally get that appointment you've been waiting for. You get home and your son doesn't believe it, doesn't want to take the medicine, and starts doing the same things again. Like, it's like when you picture that situation playing out, it's horrific. I have an uncle who has schizophrenia, and fortunately nothing like horrific has ever, or dangerous or anything has ever happened to him. But he's like his close relatives have his whole life advocated for him and tried to get him, you know, a good quality of life and get him safe and taken care of. And it's been an uphill battle the whole way. And fortunately, he has it under control and takes his medicine and manages it properly. But I can see how it could happen the other way and turn negative. But I couldn't imagine being in that situation, how hopeless you'd feel.
No, it seems like one of the most hideous of mental illnesses, you know, like there's no cure, there's only treatment, and it's described as like a naturally relapsing illness. So even if the person does take the medication, after a while, the efficacy of the medication can start to decrease, and they might not necessarily know that they're having a relapse or that they need to get their meds readjusted. It's like it's a continuous process. It's not just, hey, here's your meds, you're good to go for the rest of your life. It's like, yeah. I mean, you know what it's like. Like I take medication for anxiety and depression, and, you know, sometimes you have to increase your dose. Sometimes you have to switch to a different medication. Mm-hmm. Like it's not an exact science. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's crazy. I heard a phrase once that mental illness is not your fault, but it is your responsibility. Hmm. So it's like you have to be proactive in seeking treatment. And yeah. It's just a shame that even after this happened, that he didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, that he still continues to believe that he did the right thing.
Yeah, and then you throw the legal situation in New York in there. And I feel like that was wrong. I think he needs, like, I think he should be in a Canadian prison closer to his family.
Yeah.
And preferably not a prison. Like, it's like, I think it's pretty
mental
clear.
Health facility.
Yeah. Cause, and we need a whole nother, like, something that's in between a prison and mental health facility, because I think they're so mixed up anyway. Like, prisons and mental health facilities are in bed with each other anyway, because they have so many of the same issues and so many of the same kind of clientele passing between the two of them. I'm sure if you went through the prison, you would find a lot of people who should be in a mental health hospital.
100%, 100%. Yeah. And it's hard to prove not criminally responsible. It's hard to get that designation. So
yeah.
Unless they have like that concrete evidence that a person is in the midst of a full schizophrenic episode, it would be a very hard thing to prove.
Yeah, it would. And I think, like, I could see someone trying to fake it. But in Glenn's case, if you have a history dating back 6 or 7 years prior to the crime, but again, like, I always come back to, in this case, I always come back to his planning and methodical nature, and I can't seem to rectify that in my head. But I'm maybe if I knew more about schizophrenia and how someone may act on the delusions or whatever that they have, but it's like, when this all went down, it's 13 years ago, but I remember it so clearly, because I had gone to Steak and Stein at the time. I had Citadel Hill was right next to where I lived, and it's, you know, it's almost like Halifax's version of the CN Tower. Like, almost wherever you are downtown, you can see Citadel Hill. It's just like, it's that kind of place. But it's this is a really dark and sad story, and I feel awful for all the families involved, the families of the victims and the families of Glenn Race.
Yeah.
It's for everybody. It's everybody lost someone that they love. The Races have a kid in American prison who did a series of horrible things. Then the other families have a loved one who died in the most horrific, but also the most just pointless and bizarre way. So it's just, it's a tragedy all around. The best place, like you mentioned, that the YouTube video that showed an interview with Glenn, that came from a Toronto Star article, or a Toronto Star piece that is like the definitive piece about this case. It was written by Amy Dempsey's her name. And the article is called, I think it's called, Why Was Glenn Race Found Guilty in the United States,
but not in Canada.
Yeah. But if you even just search like Glenn Race, this is probably the first article that will come up. It's really good. And I could tell by reading that article and reading the court documents, she managed to capture a lot of, the main points in her story, but telling it in a narrative way. So that article is really good. And she also went into the prison and met with Glenn. So there's a lot of photos and video from that. So her article, like, if someone's interested in what Glenn's up to now, her article goes deep into her talks with him in prison, which is interesting, but again, really, really sad. One thing I thought we could end with, and I love your reading voice, so maybe you can do this. The Race family, Glenn's parents and brother, they released a statement to basically released it through the press. That's their official statement. They have, aside from Toronto Star, I don't think they've really talked to anyone else. So this is about all they said. If you have the statement there, would you read it?
Yeah. They say, no words can express the tremendous sorrow, the grief, and the disbelief that has gripped our family as the terrible events of the past weeks have unfolded. Events have taken the lives of three men and devastated their families and loved ones. Events for which our son has been charged. For the families of Paul Knott, Trevor Brewster, and Darcy Manor, our hearts are filled with unspeakable sorrow, and we extend our deepest sympathy and prayers in the loss of your loved ones. As a family, we have lived with and witnessed Glenn's struggle with paranoid schizophrenia for 6 years. As a father, as a mother, and as a brother, we have tried every available means to help him, to keep him in treatment. Changes in treatment options were put forward in 2005 with the passing of the Involuntary Psychiatric Treatment Act, would have provided for community treatment orders, but those changes never came into effect for our family. We have done everything that we can to assist the police with their investigations here, and we will continue to do so. We rely on their updates concerning the status of Glenn's proceedings, and there is nothing more we can add. We too have lost a loved one to a terrible illness that can be treated, but for which there are insufficient resources. We ask those who would do so to pray for the families of all who have been affected by these terrible tragedies, for all families coping with the mental illness of a loved one, and for Glenn in his anguish. Ugh.
Yeah, that's rough.
It's really rough. And like, as parents, like, I know you can too, totally imagine, like, if it's your kid who did those things, you know, like, ugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't imagine. But then from their point of view, where so much has happened, and like they say in that letter, they've been trying to get him help, and they're waiting for these like bills to pass that maybe would have given them the authority to, you know, involuntarily put him in custody or treatment or whatever. Mm. They would have been watching this happen in slow motion.
You
know, it would have been like the, watching like a plane crash in super slow motion. And it's almost like they would have been looking up at it being like, how are we going to, you know, keep that plane from hitting the ground? Like that's slowly coming down over the years. And they probably thought, you know, something bad may someday happen, but they probably never would have expected it to be something like this. But eventually they just watched it happen, trying to stop it and couldn't prevent tragedy, and here they are having lost a loved one, although he's alive in a prison in the United States.
Well, yeah, I mean, the percentage of not criminally responsible people with the designation who committed a violent crime is incredibly low. Like, people mm-hmm. should not think that others that are going through a paranoid schizophrenic episode are going to murder people. That's such a low percentage of the number of NCRs in Canada. Mm-hmm. So his parents weren't to know that he would do something violent. Most of the time it's things like public nuisance and things like that. It's mm-hmm. not full violent crimes. I really yeah. feel for his family.
Yeah, I think if it was me, I would have been worried about like him hurting himself or suicide or like a public nuisance kind of thing. But
yeah,
but it's and there's when you hear like the NCR defense, that it still has, there's a lot of taboo associated with it, and yeah. people, all you need to do is go online and find any CBC article about anything to do with the NCR defense and look at the comments, and you'll see that taboo or the kind of the ignorance in full display. But as someone who, yeah. like you said, I, with myself treating like anxiety and depression and having a family member with schizophrenia, I get that it's a very complex issue, and I don't think the criminal justice system is set up to deal with it. And I don't think the, you know, that the mental health system, if there even is one, is prepared to deal with much of anything. So,
yeah, it's a shame. I mean, here in Canada, we have, you know, we have these mental health facilities that not criminally responsible designated people are sent to, and they're monitored by a review board. But the goal is to rehabilitate them and get them back out into the community as soon as possible. And a lot of the controversy comes from people like Vincent Lee, who committed the Greyhound bus beheading of Tim McLean. He was released after, I think, 8 years, and everybody was like, this guy like beheaded a person on a Greyhound bus in front of a whole bunch of other people, and this is what he gets, 8 years, and then re-released back into the community with a new name. And I think there's a lot of issues because people, like I said before, people who are NCR and commit a violent crime are only a tiny percentage of the number of NCRs, but they're all kind of treated the same when they're given the same opportunities to be released if their doctors say that they're okay. But after the Brentwood Five massacre committed by Matthew DeGruy, that's the Calgary massacre, the families were advocating for a change in legislation which said that once they're released into the community, they have to be continuously monitored when they get their full discharge. Whereas normally when they get a full discharge, that's it, they're gone. And you don't know if they're taking their medication or if the medication is still working. So that's where a lot of the controversy comes from. And, you know, when I covered that case, I said the same thing. You know, there should be checks and balances because, as it happened, Matthew DeGroote's medication stopped being as efficient, and he was not aware that his mental health was deteriorating. So if he's released into the community and that happens, his medication just stops working. So he's been diligently taking it, but if it just stops working as effectively and he doesn't know, then the public could be at risk. So even though, you know, they are a tiny percentage of people of not criminally responsible people who have committed the violent crime, I think that there really does need to be those checks and balances when they're released.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Just like if you have there's people who have kind of illnesses where they like faint or something.
Narcolepsy and stuff.
It's like they may take your driver's license away or add different restrictions or something. So not to say that these people who have like schizophrenic episodes that end this way should be like, you know, kept in a padded cell for eternity or something. But yeah, I agree. No. There needs to be checks and balances to keep everyone safe when they do get freedom. And when I think of Glenn's story, it would be in Halifax anyway. It would be very it'd be a very big public interest story if he was ever released, because people were affected by this crime. But at the same time, it's, yeah, if he was my family member, I'm sure I'd be thinking about it a completely different way.
Absolutely.
It's hard to think about a story like this from all angles as an outsider. It's easy to see him as a monster and be like, this guy was crazy, you know, thought he was killing demons. But at the same time, it's like, if this is your brother or your cousin or your neighbor, yeah, I don't know. It's really hard to look at it and see it from both sides, which I try to do. And when I do that in this case, I just end up feeling bad for everybody.
Absolutely. And that's the way it should be. I think public opinion is so polarizing. You know, there's a bunch of people on one side who say, like, lock him up and throw out the key, the way that they used to do it in the old days. Mm-hmm. But then there's people on the other side who are like, well, if the doctors have said he's okay to be released, then just release him. But it's like, you know, there is a middle ground. Like, they can be released, but they still need to be monitored. You know, they need to have their check-ins and stuff. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a very, very contentious issue.
Mm-hmm. So we'll wrap it. We'll start wrapping it up. But before we do, Christy, what's next on Canadian True Crime?
So I have a story coming up that I'm working on from Saskatoon, and it's a very well-known story of the Saskatoon freezing deaths, which is a bunch of Indigenous men who were picked up and driven outside of town in the freezing cold and left in the snow, and several of them passed away, and they did not know what happened until one of them lived to tell the tale, and that kind of blew the whole thing open. So it's an explosive story, and people do know of it, but maybe they don't know exactly what went on and all of the details. So it's really important to me to make sure that I set aside time to cover cases like this where there's a minority group and the police are at fault, and just to really examine what happened and, you know, what the aftermath has been and what the community response was and all those types of things. So, yeah, it's one of those cases coming up.
Hopefully you never have to cover anything that's going on in the fisheries dispute in Nova Scotia. You see that in the news in Ontario, I assume?
Yeah, I have. It's an horrendous.
Yeah, it's absolutely awful. And it's like, it's so embarrassing to have that happening in Nova Scotia. I don't know. I didn't want to get into it, but I'm so like sick about it.
Yeah, I guess I follow all the right people on Twitter, so I'm only hearing the outrage. I'm not hearing from the fisher people on the other side who think everything is fine. It's very contentious.
I want to thank you for joining Christy and I in this journey through Glenn Race's troubling case. I'm sure many listeners will have differing opinions on both his culpability and on how the justice system should be handling these cases. But I think one thing's for certain, there's no easy answer. And one thing we can all agree on is that something has to be done to prevent situations like this from occurring. And with that, we'll end this episode. But before we part, I'm going to end with thanks. First of all, a massive thank you to Christy Lee for joining me on this episode. If you haven't heard her show, Canadian True Crime, you should check it out as soon as possible. And then, of course, a huge thank you to all the listeners of Nighttime, as without your interest and your support, Nighttime simply wouldn't be able to carry on. But the battle to keep the show going is still raging on, and I hope a lot of you can have my back on this. If you want to help keep the show rolling, please subscribe to the premium feed. Not only does it make the show possible, it'll give you more of each topic than you're going to hear in the free feed. You can subscribe to the premium feed at patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. And now, since I brought up the premium feed, I'm going to welcome the newest subscribers: Adam, Amy, Keegan, Angela, Max, Stephen, Kelly, Leanne, Janet, Greg, and Steve. Thank you all for your generous support. And for anyone else out there who'd like to support the show but can't help financially, you can help Canada stay weird by simply sharing the episodes on social media. And if you have any story ideas or if you want to give feedback on the show, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast.com/contact. You can also find me on social media. I use Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find me with the handle nighttimepod. Now, until next time, take care of each other, hug your loved ones tight, and advocate for families seeking better mental health resources in Canada.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.